So we are reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is Madhya Lila chapter 8, called Talks Between the Lord and Ramananda Rai. And we will begin with text 178 and work our way to 187, which is the verse on the board. So we continue with the metaphor of Srimati Radharani's form connected to love for Krishna that we discussed yesterday. Srimati Radharani's bedstead is pride itself, and it is situated in the abode of her bodily aroma. She is always seated there, thinking of Krishna's association. Srimati Radharani's earrings are the name, fame, and qualities of Lord Krishna. The glories of Lord Krishna's name, fame, and qualities are always inundating her speech. Srimati Radharani induces Krishna to drink the honey of the conjugal relationship. She is therefore engaged in satisfying all the lusty desires of Krishna. Srimati Radharani is a mine filled with valuable jewels of love for Krishna. Her transcendental body is complete with unparalleled spiritual qualities. The next verse is in Sanskrit. If one asks about the origin of love of Krishna, the answer is that the origin is in Srimati Radharani alone. Who is the most dear friend of Krishna? The answer again is Srimati Radharani alone. No one else. Srimati Radharani's hair is very curly. Her two eyes are always moving to and fro, and her breasts are firm. Since all transcendental qualities are manifested in Srimati Radharani, she alone is able to fulfill all the desires of Krishna, no one else. Purport. This is a quotation from Sri Govinda Lilamrita by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. It is a verse in the form of questions and answers describing the glories of Srimati Radharani. It's also a verse in the Sanskrit meter called Mandakranta, which means slow moving or ambling along. And its characteristic is that it begins with four slow syllables and then four short, fast syllables. Even Satyabhama, one of the queens of Sri Krishna, desires the fortunate position and excellent qualities of Srimati Radharani. All the gopis learn the art of dressing from Srimati Radharani. And even the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, and the wife of Lord Shiva, Parvati, desire her beauty and qualities. Indeed, Arundhati, the celebrated chaste wife of Vasishtha, also wants to imitate the chastity and religious principles of Srimati Radharani. Even Lord Krishna himself cannot reach the limit of the transcendental qualities of Srimati Radharani. How then can an insignificant living entity count them? Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, so far Ramananda Rai has been speaking, describing Srimati Radharani, now Mahaprabhu. Prabhu kohe, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, now I have come to understand the truth of the loving affairs between Radha and Krishna. Nonetheless, I still want to hear how both of them gloriously enjoy such love. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Rai Ramananda replied, Lord Krishna is Dhira Lalita, for he can always keep his girlfriends in a subjugated state. Thus, his only business is enjoying sense gratification. Purport. We should always remember that Krishna's sense gratification is never to be compared to the sense gratification of the material world. As we have already explained, Krishna's sense gratification is just like gold. The perverted reflection of that sense gratification found in the material world is just like iron. The purport is that Krishna is not impersonal. He has all the desires that are manifest in the perverted reflection within this material world. However, the qualities are different. One is spiritual and the other is material. Just as there is a difference between life and death, there is a difference between spiritual sense gratification and material sense gratification. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Deshatarine. So one of the most beautiful concepts in the history of religions. This is after studying the various religious traditions of the world. I think one of the most beautiful concepts in the history of religions is the concept of lila. Or here, the word is used, krida, which means play or pastime. If you imagine for a moment that you are God, okay, that's difficult to imagine, but imagine someone who is God. What would that person do with all of their time? Clearly, they wouldn't spend their days working hard at a job like you and I do, because they would already have every ounce of wealth that they needed, plus plenty more. They wouldn't spend all this time studying for an education, not a bachelor's or master's or PhD, like you and I do, because he would already have all the knowledge and education and wisdom that a person would want, plus some more. They wouldn't spend time working hard in a field or fighting with dangerous locking your doors, taking out insurance, because this person would have no fear. They would already be all powerful and have nothing to be afraid of. So what would that person spend all of their time doing? And the answer given by the Vaishnav scriptures is quite simple. Because there is nothing they would have to do in this world, they would spend their time in play. Here Prabhupada says, Krishna's only business is enjoying sense gratification. What else would you do except find newer and newer forms of sense gratification, of play, of ways to enjoy? Now, what is play? It's a word that we use very freely, and often we refer to things that are frivolous in nature or oriented towards fun or joking as play. But if we think for a moment what counts as play and how we might distinguish play from work. Take, for example, painting. Is painting play or is it work? Well, it depends, right? If you're a painter and you go every morning out in your van and with a bunch of tools and everything, and you spend your day painting people's houses and other things, then when you come home in the evening, the last thing you want to do is paint. You want to take off those, you know, colorful clothes, take a shower, and relax without touching your paintbrush. On the other hand, if you spend your days in front of a computer programming or analyzing data or whatever, then when you come home, you may want to get out of your office clothes and sit with a paintbrush and paint. In the former scenario, paint is work. In the latter scenario, paint is play. What's the difference? The activity is exactly the same in both cases. In both cases, the person is painting. But in one case, the person has to paint. there's an imperative, there's a force there to paint, because they have to make a living, and they have to raise a family, and they need money. And for that, painting is essential, because that's their profession. On the other hand, the painting is simply voluntary. It's something that he wants to do, is not forced to do. Now, if we think of this in relation to the Supreme Lord, then what is there in this world that the Lord is forced to do, that he must do? And the answer is nothing. He doesn't have to work. He doesn't have to study. He doesn't have to build. He doesn't have to paint. He doesn't have to do anything, because he already has everything. And so, therefore, everything he does is by definition play, because he's doing it only out of his own free will, only out of the freedom of his own choice, his own desire. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushana describes Leela as, he paints this scenario. He says, suppose a young man who has everything he might want in this world wakes up one morning and the sun is shining and streaming through the windows, and he gets out of bed and stretches and just starts singing and dancing. And we might ask, why? Why are you singing here? What's the purpose behind it? And the answer is nothing. There's no purpose. He's not trying to achieve anything. It's just an overflowing of his own happiness, his own inner joy. We all have experienced moments like this in our life, where we're humming a tune, or we're just happy. And there's no particular reason to do what we're doing, except we're just happy. Most of our life is spent goal-oriented. We have to get here by this time. We have to do this by this time in order to achieve this, which will lead to this, and this needs to be done. And we've got a list of obligations that we work through to the end of the day. And then by the end of the day, we're exhausted. And so then we plop down on the couch and we watch something or we read something or whatever. But even that doesn't count as play, because it's just unwinding after a lot of exhaustion, a lot of work. When a person's inner happiness overflows just because of who they are, that's called Leela. And everything the Lord does, everything he does, because there is no force, there is no requirement, there is no karma in the Lord's life and existence, therefore everything Krishna does is Leela, is play. This doesn't mean that everything he does is always joking and, you know, making light of things. Krishna sometimes does very serious things. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha dushkritam. Sometimes he's protecting his devotees very seriously, very carefully. Sometimes he's destroying the demons, which requires a lot of focus. Krishna does a lot of serious things. It's not that he's always just frivolous. But even those serious acts, even those serious things, are still play. They're still Leela, because there is no force. They're a result of his own free will, his own sweet will. So that means everything Krishna does, everything he does is Leela. It's Krida. That's why Prabhupada says, Jai Shri Radha Gokulananda. This is why Ramananda Rai is saying his only business is enjoying sense gratification. What a great translation, no, of this phrase. Kama krida nirantara kama krida jahara charita. His character, charita, is constant play. Nirantara kama krida. His only business is sense gratification. Prabhupada has this way of translating things that are both simultaneously sweet and that open our mind, right? It's a shocking translation. We think of sense gratification typically in negative terms. And here Prabhupada is blowing apart that idea and saying sense gratification is negative, no doubt, but only in certain contexts, only in the material world where it is selfishly oriented. When Krishna is satisfying his senses, that's not selfish. That's the goal of every living entity, is to satisfy the senses of Krishna. That's our identity. That's who we are. We're made to satisfy not our senses, but the senses of Krishna. Jiver sarupoi krishner nitya das. That's our role. And therefore, that sense gratification is glorious. Right? That sense gratification is glorious. So this is what Krishna is doing, is nirantara lila, nirantara kama krida, always playing. But in order to play, in order to do lila, you need something. Play doesn't happen on its own. The most important ingredient for play is people to play with. There's no play alone. You can play alone, but it doesn't last very long. It gets boring very quickly. How many movies are you going to binge on? And even with movies, there's other people there, right? You're experiencing the emotions of others. And any activity that we enjoy is a result of our connection with others. That's the most important ingredient. You can ask any child and say, what do you need to play? In those days, mom, I'm bored. Why are they bored? Because there's no friends. For play, we need people to play with. And therefore, for lila, we need rasa. Rasa means those intensified emotions that are a result of relationship. So right away, if God is the abode of all lila, lila purushottam, then it follows that he has to be the abode of all rasa, or relationships. Akhila rasamrita murti, Rupa Goswami says. He is the embodiment of every kind of relationship possible. Because if your only business is to enjoy sense gratification, and you have to do this unlimitedly, you have to play unlimitedly, you need an unlimited number of people to play with. And an unlimited number of relationships within which to play. This is why the Chandogya Upanishad says that in the beginning there was only one. Sadeva Somya Idamagra Asit. In the beginning there was only Sat. Tadaikshata. But he thought, Bahusyam, let me become many. Why? Because there is no enjoyment being alone. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has this beautiful passage where he says, the original being became many. Why? Because there is no joy, there is no pleasure being alone. And so this is beautifully described in one of the opening defining verses of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, which describes who Srimati Radharani is, why she is there, right? He says, Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Hladini Shaktirasmat. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Hladini Shaktirasmat. Ekatmanav Abhibhuvipura Deha Vedam Gatoto. Chaitanyakhyam Prakatamadhuna Tadvayam Chaikyamaptam. Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupam. Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupam. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir. Radharani, who is she? Krishna Pranaya Vikriti. She is the transformation of love for Krishna. She is the embodiment, the manifestation of Krishna's love. Krishna Pranaya Vikritir. Hladini Shaktir. She is Krishna's pleasure potency. Ekatmanav api bhuvi bhupura deha bhedam gatauto. Although they are one being, one person, api bhuvi pura, from time immemorial, deha bhedam, they have become two. They have created this duality, the original duality. Radha and Krishna. Why? For the purpose of rasa. Because lila cannot happen alone. Okay? So, the Supreme Lord, if he is actually supreme, he's not going to spend his time judging people or creating worlds. He can delegate all that work to others. He can manifest himself in innumerable forms as Chaturvyuha and Mahavishnu and Garbhodakashaya Vishnu and Kshirodakashaya Vishnu to take care of all the different functions of this world. Creation, maintenance, destruction, managing the affairs of the world. He's got plenty of people. He's going to spend his time in play. But for play, for lila, he needs relationship, rasa. Now, with relationship, there's a big problem, which is that relationships in this world tend to be very selfishly oriented. And this is why Srila Prabhupada, in the purport, he's making this very important distinction, given in Chaitanya Charitamrita itself, that the relationships of Krishna are like gold, and the relationships in this world are like iron. This example indicates what? That there's a certain degree of similarity between them. Gold and iron are both metals, and someone who has seen iron has the capacity to appreciate what gold might be like, even if we don't have a lot of it. Right, but we know it's metallic and it's solid and it's shiny. Right, there's certain qualities of iron that we can see reflected in gold, but in value, in purity, the two are very different, extremely different. So the quality of relationship in this world is that it ends up always having some degree of selfishness in it, sometimes a lot of selfishness. Like the relationship between employer and employee, right? If I were not paid for my job, I certainly would not keep working, right? Probably you wouldn't either. It's not a very selfless relationship. You pay me, I work for you. That's the deal, right? So some relationships are clearly selfish, and others maybe less so, right? You can see it at certain times in the relationship. When that person doesn't satisfy our senses in the way we want, then the relationship starts to fall apart. Every relationship in this world has at least a little tinge of it. Some are very much like iron. Some are slightly more like gold. But if you take that gold and you melt it and melt it and burn it and burn it and purify it, unlimitedly purifying, tapta kanchana, right? Make it very, very pure. That relationship, that rasa, which is completely purified of any extraneous contamination in that metal, that rasa is called prema. Prema is that love, that relationship, that is so well purified that there is not a trace of contamination, of selfishness present within it. So lila leads to rasa, leads to prema. And then we take that prema and we think of that person who embodies the furthest, highest reaches of that prema, whose very existence, every aspect of their existence is imbued, is saturated with that prema. Who never wavers from the purity of that love, even for a flickering moment. If we think of that ultimate embodiment of prema, that is Srimati Radharani. That's Sri Radha. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikriti. And therefore, tapta kanchana gaurangi radhe vrindavaneshwari. Her complexion itself is like molten gold, because her love is like molten gold. Her heart is pure like gold, gold with no contamination in it whatsoever. And this is why when we hear of Krishna always engaged in pastimes of sexual enjoyment, kama krida, when we hear of the gopis and Srimati Radharani always satisfying Krishna's lusty desires, we have to recognize that we're talking about something in a totally different arena altogether. How much work we have to do to get to that, to understand that. This is not cheap titillation of the senses in the body. We are in this world, as Prabhupada is saying, the difference between life and death. We are miles away. We live in a world where everything we do is work. We have to think of a world where everything we do is play. And then we have to think of a world where that play is done in relationship with others, limitlessly. And then we have to think of a world where that relationship is so pure that there's not a trace of selfishness in it. And then we have to take that selfless love and we have to take it to the highest reaches and embody it in a person whose very existence is constituted of that love. And then, if we can understand all of that, then we can understand this love that is being talked about here. And so it's like gold and iron, like life and death, Prabhupada is saying in the purport. This is why Prabhupada, any opportunity he gets, he reminds us of this fact. As we were reading, Krishna keeps his girlfriends in a subjugated state. His only business is sense gratification. The gopis are satisfying his lusty desires. If I had stopped at that point and said, now there's a purport from Prabhupada, what's he going to say? I think many of us could have guessed exactly what he was going to say. This type of lust is not our material lust. How many times have we heard that from Prabhupada? Prabhupada is crystal clear. He's repeatedly reminding us of that. In order to help us understand just what we're talking about, to help us avoid confusing that which is material for that which is spiritual. There's two things that Prabhupada never misses an opportunity to remind us about. When we're talking about Radha and Krishna's love, he never misses an opportunity to remind us that this is not like the temporary love of this world, the selfish love of this world. And the other opportunity Prabhupada never misses is what? An opportunity to refute Mayavad philosophy. And so here, in the middle of this metaphor describing the highest reaches of love between Radha and Krishna, what does Prabhupada say in the purport? He says, the purport is that Krishna is not impersonal. He, in the middle of this, he takes this off. I remember when I was reading this. So I was driving. This is a few days ago when I was in the United States. I was driving. I knew Divinam Prabhu had told me that this was the verse we got to do. So I asked Chaitanya, my older son, who was sitting up front, to read this translation and purport for me so I could start thinking about what I wanted to say. And he read the purport. And the first thing he said afterwards, he said, Papa, Prabhupada is always criticizing the Mayavadis, isn't he? Even he gets it, that this is something you don't. And I've met so many people who will say the same thing. They'll say, what is it? Why is he always after the Mayavadis? Why is he always after impersonalism? And the reason is very simple. It's very simple. Because imagine what we would be left with if we were impersonalists. If we believed that ultimate reality is nondescript, it has no name, no qualities, no attributes, no form, no activity, no lila, no rasa, no prema, what would we be left with in that situation? Think about it for a moment. Would there be any beauty in this world? Yes, well, maybe in some temporal sense. We could still say things in this world are beautiful. But ultimately, no. Why? Because you've got two options for impersonalism. They're described in Prabhupada's pranamantras. Namaste Sarasvate Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi. Right? Prabhupada's mission, Paschatya Deshatarine, is to protect us from Nirvishesha and Shunyavad. You've got two options. One is to say that this world is a collection of chemicals. It's a process, right? These chemicals move through certain processes. There are processes of change in this world that produce different phenomena. But in the end, it's all the same thing. It's temporary material phenomena. A version of this is taught by certain types of scientists. A version of this is taught by certain types of Buddhists. Right? The idea is that where is there beauty in the world? It's a collection of chemicals, and those chemicals dissolve over time. Or, if you're a little more elevated, you think, no, it's not just chemicals. There's an ultimate reality that has no name and qualities and form, etc. There is some substance. It's not just matter. There is a spiritual substance. But that spiritual substance is nondescript. And therefore, any beauty that there is must be only vyavaharika. It must be only worldly. It's only here. And as soon as we transcend this world, then we lose it. It slips through our fingers. It disappears. No beauty. Would there be a space for relationship? Would there be a space for love? No. In this world, maybe. But as soon as you transcend this world, it slips through your fingers once again. There's no love. There's no relationship because there's no individuality. Would there be a room for personal initiative? For unique personalities and distinctiveness, for personal ambition and choice and free will? No. Because as you move higher, these would all slip through your fingers. Because there are no individuals, there is no personality, there is no difference between you and me. Would there be room for mercy, for compassion? Would there be anyone up there we can look to for help? We can call to for support? Would there be anyone up there who cares? No. Because what is there? Just me. I am everything. Aham Brahmasmi. And if that's all you end with, then there is no one looking after you. You are on your own in a world that has nothing but you. What a frightening thought. So this is why Prabhupada is so keen on making this point clear. Because when we go down the path of impersonalism, we lose everything. Nama, rupa, guna, lila, everything that we value. This whole sequence that we describe, lila leads to rasa, leads to prema, leads to this ultimate form of prema that is Srimati Radharani. Everything is lost. It's cut at the very root. And so these two things, Prabhupada is always keen on warning us against. On the one hand, sahajiya, and on the other hand, mayavad. The difference, and Prabhupada, in this purport, he addresses both. It's one paragraph, a mere 5-6 sentences. And in those sentences, Prabhupada makes both points. The love of Radha and Krishna is like gold versus iron. What is he warning us against? Sahaja mentality. Krishna is not impersonal, he says. What is he warning against? Mayavad. The difference between these two is very simple, very straightforward. Sahajiya philosophy means to take what is material and to consider it spiritual. So a Sahajiya thinks, this material body of mine is just like Krishna. And so just the way that Krishna enjoys himself, so I can enjoy myself. And the love I experience with my wife or my husband or my girlfriend or boyfriend, that is like Krishna's love. So it's taking what is material and turning it into, considering it spiritual. And the Mayavadi is one who takes that which is spiritual and considers it to be material. What does that mean? Krishna's form, his pastimes, his paraphernalia, everything is spiritual, but a Mayavadi is one who thinks, nope, that's all material. Krishna's form, his body, his pastimes are all like ours. Krishna, when he appears in this world, we talked about this yesterday as avatar, right? The impersonalist idea of the avatar. He takes a body just like mine that is subject to decay and death. So the Sahajiya is one who takes that which is material and considers it spiritual. And the Mayavadi is one who considers that which is spiritual and turns it into material. The right path is right in the middle. Most good things are right in the middle. The middle way, as the Buddha taught us, is the best. Spiritual life, the Upanishad says, is like a razor's edge. And it's very difficult to get it just right. And it's so easy to slip off to one side or the other. So easy. There are very, very few spiritual institutions in the world that manage not to slip into Sahajiyavad or Mayavad. Very few. In fact, this is a very easy way to test any translation of Bhagavad Gita. This is my personal litmus test, looking at a new translation. There's new translations coming out just about every year. And you want to check the quality of it? Turn to chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita. Those famous verses, yada yada hi dharmasya paritranaya sadhunam, and ajopisan avyayatma bhutanam ishvaropisan prakritim swamadhishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. And see what the translator does with those verses. A lot of translators are very favorable towards bhakti, and they do a nice job. But these verses are the real litmus test. Most translators will translate those verses as, I come to this world again and again and create a body for myself. Prakritim swam adhishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. By my own maya, I take on a body made of prakriti, matter. Most will do that. It takes a very, very, very careful translator who knows Siddhanta to be able to get that verse to be not Mayavadi. So this is a very difficult, very subtle thing to get it just right. And we are very fortunate to have the shelter of Srila Prabhupada, who makes this line crystal clear everywhere we turn, who is so protective of us that he ensures that no matter what happens, we don't get this wrong. You can get other things wrong, details, But he doesn't want us to get this wrong. And so he reminds us in every book, every chapter, nearly every purport, to ensure that we don't lose the very reason that we're doing all of this. That we slip into something and end up losing the very heart of why we're doing it. You know, there's a lot of arguments back and forth between Mayavadis and Vaishnavas. It's, Prabhupada says, this is a very old argument. It's been going on for thousands of years, literally, from the time of Shankaracharya, even before that, the argument between the personalists and the impersonalists. And the reason the argument continues is because both sides are really good philosophers. Sometimes we like to laugh at the Mayavadis as ridiculous. But if you read Shankaracharya's philosophy, it is powerful. It is convincing. He's really, really one of the smartest people, one of the most brilliant people that have ever walked this earth. And I'm not saying that as an exaggeration. There's a reason his philosophy is famous in its full form or watered down forms, but it's famous everywhere. It's very convincing. This is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Mayavada bhashya shunile hoi sarvanash. Because it's really, really convincing. Of course, the arguments by the Vaishnavas against are even more convincing. And Ramanujacharya gives 7 points that are, they're called the 7 great untenables, Saptavida Anupapatti, that are very powerful to cut down Mayavad philosophy, the concept of Maya. But then they come back with additional arguments against Ramanujacharya. And then Ramanuja's followers and Madhvacharya comes with further arguments again. And then they come back again. And then they come back, and it goes on and on and on and on. And that argument has been going on for thousands of years and continues to go on today. And if you enjoy this kind of thing, you can get a lot of pleasure reading these arguments back and forth. It's candy for the mind. But it all comes down to one thing. After reading these arguments back and forth, over and over again, ultimately, I think it comes down to one question. And that question is a choice. What kind of world do you want to ultimately live in? What kind of world do you ultimately want to live in? Do you want to live in a world where ultimate reality, the ultimate world that you want to work towards, that you want to spend eternity in, is it a world that is ever-present, peaceful, uniform, nameless, without individuality, complete quiet, no difference? There's a certain attractiveness to that, especially for someone who suffered a lot in the material world. The idea of more relationships is horrible. So the idea of a place where you can just turn everything off, is there's an attractiveness to that, right? To peace. This is why people come to the temple and they say, why are you coming? Man ki shanti. I'm getting peace of mind. This is important for someone suffering. That's the first step, to have peace. So do you want to live in a world with like that? No name, no form, no relationship, no individuality. In its place, you have uniformity, you have peace, you have nondescript reality. Or do you want to live in a world of constant variety, of dynamism, of activity, of relationship, of kama krida, play of love? A world where there is pure love, founded on pure relationship, founded on a desire for enjoyment. Is that the world you want to live in? That's what it comes down to, ultimately. Is that choice? It comes down to our individual choice of what is the ultimate reality that we want to inhabit, that we want to live in. Because philosophically, there's no end to the debate. Shrutayo vibhinna naiko rishir yasya matam pramanam. Yudhishthira Maharaj says in Bhagavatam, all the rishis will have different opinions. And all the scriptures will have different interpretations. And people will come up with all kinds of ideas. Naiko rishir yasya matam pramanam. There's no pramana there. The question is, what world do you want to live in? And once you make that choice of what world you want to live in, then mahajano yena gata sapanta, find someone who lives in that world already and follow that person. And then your way is set. Whether or not the details of the argument are clear or not, doesn't matter so much. And that choice, I think, is expressed very beautifully in one purport of Srila Prabhupada's, in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where I think Prabhupada doesn't make an extended argument against impersonalism in the way he does in other places. But I find it to be personally one of the most powerful arguments for personalism, for bhakti, and against impersonalism. It's just, he does it in one sentence at the end of this purport. So this is in the chapter in first canto where, that describes the passing away of Bhishma Dev. And you know, Bhishma Dev is lying on his bed of arrows, and he has finished his instructions to Maharaj Yudhishthira on all manner of dharma. And now the sun has entered its proper phase for departure, right? It's in its, the days have started to become longer, the bright half of the year, the bright half of the month, and Bhishma Dev is looking forward to leaving this world in the manner of a yogi. And so he's focusing all his mind and heart and intelligence on Krishna, who is standing there right before him. And he envisions his favorite form of the Lord, his favorite moment in his relationship with the Lord. In each of our lives, we have those times where Krishna has especially appeared to us. He's impacted us, where we've felt his presence. And those moments are very special. We were discussing this last night. They form our personal library of events in our life where Krishna has done his pastimes in our life. And Bhishma Dev had his moments that he held very dear. And his favorite, of course, was Krishna on the battlefield as the chariot driver of Arjuna, Partha Sarathi. And he's got a beautiful description of him holding the reins of the chariot in his hand and in the other hand holding the whip for the horses. And his hair is turned ashen because of the dust kicked up by the hooves of those horses. As a charioteer, you're right there, right next to the horses. All that dust is coming on you. And beads of sweat decorate his forehead. And even there's some blood from the wounds that are dealt by his arrows, Bhishma's arrows. He considers this a great accomplishment, that he was able to do this to Krishna. And then he remembers that same Krishna breaking his promise, jumping off that chariot, because Bhishma Dev had made life so difficult for Arjuna. He had practically brought him to the point of death that Krishna could not tolerate it anymore. In fact, Bhishma had made this promise. He had said, "Today I vow to kill Arjuna. And the only way for that to stop is if Krishna breaks his vow to not fight in the battle." So he had basically pit his vow against Krishna's and said, now who's going to win? My promise or Krishna's promise? And Krishna, he's always eager, Prabhupada says. He says he's always eager to let the devotee win. To make sure that the devotee's promise is kept, even at the cost of his own. And so he rushes off, and Bhishma Dev is describing this. He rushes off that chariot, picks up a wheel, and runs towards him. He says, like a lion coming to an elephant, to kill an elephant. Think of that beautiful analogy, that beautiful metaphor. Bhishma Dev is not considering himself to be a fly or to be some minor thing. He knows he's an elephant. This is his relationship with Krishna. He knows Krishna can defeat him, so he's the lion. But I'm no, you know, mouse. I'm an elephant. As a lion chases an elephant, Krishna picks up that wheel, runs, and he says along the way, he even drops his upper cloth. Imagine the detail with which Bhishma is watching Krishna on the battlefield. This is a moment of life and death. Arjun's about to die. Bhishma's about to die if Krishna continues. And what's Bhishma's focus? Krishna's dropped his upper cloth. Wow! Look at that. And he's angry. And he's breaking his promise for me. And please, kill me. I don't care. He doesn't mind. This is the moment he's been living for. This is his success. He's victorious now. He won. Krishna is having to do this all for him. And Prabhupada says in the purport, he says, Krishna runs towards Bhishma like a lover runs towards his beloved. And this is what Bhishma is feeling. This is what he's seeing. Everyone on the battlefield is thinking, is Arjuna going to live? Is Bhishma going to live? Who's going to win today? That's not Bhishma's concern. He's in that moment thinking like this. As a lover runs towards his beloved, Krishna is running towards Bhishma. And Bhishma's sharp arrows, Prabhupada says, are like the Krishna feels like a shower of flowers upon his body. That's what they're experiencing. And Prabhupada ends that purport by saying, and those who want, those impersonalists who want liberation from the Lord to merge into an existence, Krishna gives them that. But for as for the devotees, this is what they get. And I think in that moment, Prabhupada says it all. He paints this beautiful picture, this beautiful vision that is underneath what's actually happening on the battlefield. Krishna and Bhishma Dev are experiencing something so intense. He lays it out like a beautiful cake. And then he says, oh, and if you want that, those dry husks there, you can have it. Krishna will give it to you, he says. Krishna fulfills everyone's desire, and he will give the impersonalist the liberation that he wants. But as for the devotee, this is what he wants. And to me, that's the ultimate argument. Outside the details of the philosophical pieces, which are all very interesting, and we can go into it in plenty of detail, but this is what it comes down to, is what kind of world do you want to live in? And that's a choice we make every day, every moment of our lives. We choose to be personalists or impersonalists. We choose to treat Krishna as a person or as an impersonal force in this world. When we go to work, when we take care of our children, when we do our japa every day, when we do kirtan, when we read Bhagavatam, are we interacting with Krishna, the person? Or are we engaging in some ritual for an impersonal God for whom we have certain duties to fulfill? When we relate to each other, Are we doing it as persons, in a personal way, in a community of devotees that truly values and embodies personal relationships? That rasa that we hope to achieve one day? Or do we go about our activities treating each other as cogs in a big wheel of duty and activity and service and so many things? This is a choice that we make. And if we choose to see Krishna as a person, then we can see him at work in every aspect of our lives. We can see him act in our own life, just as he acted in the life of Bhishma Dev. We can see him in our lives, in those moments that seem ordinary from the perspective of the world. That scene, Krishna and Bhishma, for the rest of everyone, it was just... Prabhupada says, Arjun could not see this scene of Krishna as the chariot driver because Arjun was behind him. This image, Krishna sitting as the charioteer with his reins in one hand and the whip in the other and covered with sweat and ashen face, with Arjun behind him holding the bow, that vision was not available to Arjun. It was not Arjuna's relationship with Krishna. That vision was created specifically for Bhishma Dev. For everyone else there around, missed it entirely. But for Bhishma, it was the moment of his life. So too for us. Ordinary moments, ordinary days, ordinary activities that in the eyes of the world seem completely banal, completely normal, completely day-to-day. Krishna can act in our lives if we choose to see him as a person. Those moments can be opportunities to engage in our relationship with Krishna. And all that requires is that everything we do, we don't have to do anything extraneous. Everything we do in our practice of bhakti, we do with meaning. We do with feeling. Anyway, we have to chant our rounds. Anyway, we have to dance in kirtan. Anyway, we have to rise early in the morning. Anyway, we have to offer our obeisances when we come into the temple. We do these things. If we're practicing, if we're sincere, we do these things. Why not take the opportunity to do them with meaning, to do them with feeling? Even something as simple as putting our head on the ground and offering obeisances. How many times do we do that? We come into the temple, we offer obeisances. We leave, we offer obeisances. We come before Prabhupada, we offer obeisances. We meet a devotee, we offer obeisances. Just something so simple like that. We can make that a moment of connection with Krishna. If we do it, if we think about what we're doing. If we do it with meaning, and hopefully one day, if we do it with feeling. So I'll stop there. Thank you all so much for your attention today and for discussing this wonderful purport with us of Srila Prabhupada, where he takes the highest exemplar of love in this world and he shows us what it is by distinguishing it from what it is not. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.